The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And what I have in mind to do tonight, as well as the next couple of Monday nights, is to give a series of talks about the Buddhist teachings on peace, nonviolence, and violence. Because those topics, peace and nonviolence, and the critique of violence, lay really at the center, the heart of Buddhism. So it's a very important part of this tradition. But I think even more important is, Buddhism itself is really a small thing. Not that important in some ways. What's important is peace. What's important is the freedom from conflict. What's important is some profound experience of inner peace, freedom, compassion, love, and some experience of external peace. And I think that there's a very powerful impulses or motivations in human beings to move towards peace, to cultivate peace, to develop peace, to work with compassion, to work with love. And these are forces which I think are often underrepresented in the popular press because the movements of nonviolence, of peace, of love and compassion tend to be movements that are done in small increments, small pieces. Whereas some of the big, violence is often enough that makes the news, happens in big chunks and, big events. And so it's kind of, it's easier to write about, it has a bigger impact. But for every act of violence we read about in the newspaper, there's probably 10,000 acts of simple kindness, simple movements towards making peace, maybe more, maybe a million, 10 million that go on in our world. A mother that manages to reconcile her two children when they're fighting is creating peace. That doesn't make it in the newspaper very often. But I think it's very significant. And so there's a lot of movements like that. And I think that there's a great... possibility for peace, a great possibility for the kind of compassionate life that isn't limited to Buddhism. But Buddhism is really a small thing in the service of creating some kind of really lasting or deeper peace, certainly in people's hearts, but also in the world that we live, hopefully. And there are many people in the world, many religions, many different non-religious traditions that have the same impulse to somehow find peace, find compassion, act from love. And I think those things are really important. And that's why I say Buddhism is really a small thing. It's a little aid and support for this very much more important enterprise that we're about. One of my heroes, I have a lot of heroes. I like having heroes. The more the better, as far as I'm concerned. But one of my great heroes is Martin Luther King. And he wrote, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence, and toughness multiplies toughness in a descending spiral of destruction. The chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall be plunged into the darkness of annihilation." Must be broken. I think so. I'll give you a small example. I've talked before. About 5 years ago, when my older son was, I suppose he was about seven, I used what I occasionally used on him, which is I used my strong voice. And perhaps that was a little bit of a kind euphemism for using my strong voice. Thou shalt not do that again, or something. Very strong language. You get his attention. It was hard to get his attention sometimes. And so, you know, he was doing something that just shouldn't happen. And it was very effective to use a strong voice. And because it was kind of like, you know, I'm this big, powerful guy in his eyes, I suppose. And it's kind of certainly intimidating. It's kind of, it was, you know, a little bit over-the-top kind of strength. And, good, that was good. It worked. He stopped what he was doing. Great. Only to have some days later, to hear him use the same voice to his younger brother. When I heard that, I said, uh-oh. What have I done? What are the consequences? I could get what I wanted to have accomplished in the moment was accomplished, but it was accomplished at a great cost. And the cost was a conditioning, an example to my younger son of what was allowable, what could be done. And he then you know, turned around and did it again. Do we do that as you know, do we do that more outside of our family? Do we do that in nations? War begets more war. There's so much war. They say, they claimed in the 20th century that they were fighting wars to end all war. Right? Didn't they say that? There was twice they said that. So, I'm afraid what's going to happen if they say it a third time. And it's very easy to justify violence. It's too easy. And what's really sad is too many times both parties justify violence. Both parties feel like they're just. It's sanctioned. You know, certainly it's sanctioned to use violence against people who are being violent, unsanctioned violence, right? Those people are unjust. So we're going to stop those unjust people. But many times, they feel they're just. And so how do we, you know, how do we make out? But it's easy to get, you know, seemingly easy to get quick results, to use your big gun. It's a lot more difficult to approach violence, nonviolence, or to approach nonviolence, find other alternatives to violence. Because it takes more thought, it takes more care. It actually, I think it takes a lot more, a stronger character than the easy use of violence, of a gun. As I've said, there was a woman many years ago when we were teaching in Palo Alto who came to me after one of these Monday night talks and said that when she parks in downtown Palo Alto, she doesn't feel safe. And she's thinking of getting a gun. And what did I think of that? And I didn't want to be in a position, be in the role of telling her you should or shouldn't have a gun. I thought you shouldn't, for sure. But I didn't want to be in the role exactly. But what I told her was, I think it's really sad that a person might go to that quick answer rather than doing the more involved answer, which might be a involved kind of approach, which is take some classes in nonviolent defense. Learn the skills of how to handle yourself to some greater success rather than resorting to carrying a gun. Both having a gun and having trained oneself to have other approaches to deal with violence, they all have risks involved. There's no guarantee that any of them is going to work. Even having a gun is no guarantee it's going to help. And nonviolent approaches are not going to, you know, not, no guarantee as well. But what kind of society do we want? And do we, you know, and what kind of society do we want to build? What kind of, how do we want to condition our children, the people around us, to what we want to do? Or are we lazy? Or do we feel somehow selfish? There's a lot of narcissism in our society. You know, that it's my way, I have to have my way. You know, it's if I can't get this trouble out of my sight, I want to get it out of here as quickly as possible. And so some violent approach can get that done. I read some years ago, I read an amazing theory about the American Revolutionary War. I grew up mostly in American schools where the Revolutionary War was glorified to no end. The great heroes, great, this amazing, wonderful thing, not only for the United States, but for the world, you know, to cast off the tyranny of England and give birth to this great democratic country. It's just like, it was one of the great, you know, moments in civilization. In some ways it was. But, you know, before the Revolutionary War, the colonists did a lot of nonviolent protests against the English. So much so that the English governor of New York wrote back to England, to the crown, to say, I have no power outside the fort. I can, you know, you're writing these laws in England, and I'm supposed to implement them here in the colony in New York, and no one's going to listen to me. That's quite something to write back and say. So the question, the theory was, or the challenge was, if the colonists had not resorted to violence to get rid of the English, how long would it have taken for the English, for the colonists to become free anyway? Would it have taken 10 years? 20 years? I mean, Canada got free eventually. Did they shoot? When did Canada become free of England? Who knows? No one knows? What? Are they free? Are we free? We're still not free of that violence.
They didn't fight.
They didn't. Oh, yeah, there we go. A Canadian.
They didn't fight, but they took many, many years, and the Queen is still
figurehead. I wouldn't mind having the Queen as, you know, if all those people hadn't been killed, it's a pretty good exchange. So I don't know. So it's a challenge, you know. How long would it have taken? And if people had been trained in nonviolent civil disobedience, could they have done it quicker than the Canadians that did it? I think that's a very interesting question. And it kind of it's a difficult thing to bring up a field because it rubs against what's kind of almost sacred in the United States, this attitude about the Revolutionary War and violence and how important that was. But what if it had only taken 10 years to do it a different way? I believe that when there's war and violence, everybody loses. The victor loses. If you look at what goes on now with the American soldiers coming back from Iraq, it's a huge tragedy. Even if America should completely win Iraq or win Afghanistan, everybody in Afghanistan lives happily ever after. I mean, this, you know, the amount of suffering that's been caused to people who went through that here, the trauma, the suicides, the wounding. Now, and the families that have been affected of the dead soldiers, I mean, all those people have lost. They've lost something very deep. So is there another way? Or can we entertain another way? Could we study other ways? Could we be interested? Are there other ways? Maybe there are times when violence is justified, but I find that people are much too quick to want to justify it. Just as I find that people in this circle, in the Buddhist kind of circles I teach in, if I give a talk about working with anger, you know, and being wise about anger and, you know, practicing with it, whatever, inevitably someone stands up and wants to justify anger. There's this very powerful instinct to justify it. And I don't understand what that instinct is, to justify violence or anger. it's okay to justify it sometimes. Maybe sometimes it's okay to use. But what about studying, training in other forms of dealing with conflict besides the ones that are violent? When I was, I'm Norwegian, and I went back to live in Norway when I was 20. And so that was a, in Norwegian there was, in Norway there's mandatory military service. And so I didn't really feel there was much danger of being called in, but they had to, it was still kind of my friends were in the military service and a variety of things. And something like 10% of Norwegians are conscientious objectors. So they don't have to do military service. But what they have to do is it's 1 year military service or 2 years of civil service if you're a conscientious objector. And so like you work in a hospital for 2 years or something. It's an alternative. But some of my friends in Norway didn't like this. They were conscientious objectors. They didn't want to fight. They didn't want to be in this in the army. But they wanted to be able to defend the country if it was ever attacked. And, you know, just, you know, working in a hospital is nice, but they wanted to be actually actively involved in defense. And they wanted, they were petitioning the government to set up a nonviolent boot camp. Because there's a science, maybe that's a little bit lofty term, but there's a science of civil disobedience, of nonviolent action, that's becoming increasingly sophisticated. There are university departments, university professors, scholars, who spend lifetimes studying all the myriad examples of nonviolent civil disobedience that have succeeded and not succeeded in the world, and studied how they work, what these techniques are like, and develop them so that with the idea that they can be studied and learned. And as people become more sophisticated and trained in these things, then they can, you know, be much more effective in dealing with conflict. So I'll give you one little example. Maybe it's not silly, but maybe it's... I think it was in Czechoslovakia when the Russians invaded. The Russians had a really hard time in 1968 when they invaded the Russian army into Czechoslovakia. Repeatedly, the Russian army lost the battle without a single bullet being fired. And that's because the people of Prague and Czechoslovakia resisted nonviolently, massively. And they would get up on the tanks, Russian soldiers would come in with big tanks, and the crowds of people would climb on the tanks and offer flowers. And what happened was that the soldiers, the first few waves of soldiers, Russian soldiers coming to Czechoslovakia, couldn't fight. They said, we can't do this. And so the Russians had to bring in fresh people from Russia who hadn't been already been influenced by all the flowers, all those kind people saying, you know, we don't want you here. But my favorite little nonviolent technique was the Czechs would, they scrambled the road signs. The street signs, you know. So the Russians would come into the town with, you know, with their maps. They didn't have GPS back then. So these maps, and they say, you know, they make a right on, you know, Prague Street, and Prague Street would take you down to the garbage dump. And so the Czechs knew, you know, what the streets were, but so it's a small little thing, and but there's a whole slew of that, and also to study all the successful examples. They don't make big news, but there's been lots, well, some of them do, big examples. So, of course, Gandhi stands out as a preeminent example of nonviolent, success of nonviolent action. But Gandhi was a student of history, and he had learned how nonviolence had worked in China, in Russia, in England, and also in the colonies in the United States. He had lots and lots of examples that he used as kind of inspire him or to teach him what was possible. The Chinese, in 1900, were boycotting American goods in order to protest the discriminatory immigration policies or attitudes that America had towards the Chinese. I don't know how successful it was, but Gandhi studied this. A boycott, look at that. And so he was aware of many, many examples. And then Gandhi himself then inspired others. And as I think many of you know, Gandhi inspired was an inspiration for Martin Luther King. The term that Dr. King used, soul power, was his translation of a term coined by Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi had the word satyagraha, which means kind of like adhering to the truth. The power, sometimes it's said, power of truth. And so he took those words, satya means truth and graha means adhering, and he translated it into soul power, because maybe that worked well for his mostly Christian kind of people. So here's a great Martin Luther King quote. This was apparently in one of his very first, an early sermon, 1957. He was quoting from the Gospel of Matthew, which says, apparently, ye have heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. Does it really say that in Matthew? It really says that? It doesn't say that. She says it does. None of people know you. It says that. She's pretty. I know the love thy neighbor part. I hear that a lot. Oh, you know. You were in seminary. Right? It says that. I saw that, and I was kind of amazed. Anyway, I'm amazed by many things easily, I guess. So it says, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. So here's what Martin Luther King, that's what it says in his Bible. And this is what he said after reading that to his congregation. What?
But it's followed by what I say unto you.
Yeah. Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh. Oh, I'm so sorry. I couldn't understand the text here.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. That's great that you could correct me so quickly. Okay. So, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. See, it looks like the quotation ends there. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you. So, okay, I guess that's the quote. Great. What a great, that's inspiring. Gee. And then Dr. King says, let us deal with this practical question. How do you go about loving your enemies? I guess the first thing is this. In order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. And I'm sure that that seems strange to you, that I start out telling you this morning that you love your enemies by beginning with a look at self. Isn't that great? Apparently. So, you know, I think that's certainly my belief, that if we're going to have any hope in the world, to change the world, to become a more peaceful place, we can't ignore ourselves. We can't be looking out there and say, they have to do it. It's up to them. But rather, we have to look and see, how do you treat your children, or your neighbors, or your colleagues? How do you treat yourself? What's the impulses that drive your heart? Is it love? Is it hate? Not simply to answer it kind of yes, what you hope it is, but to train the heart, to train yourself, your mind, to be able to respond with love, with kindness, in a way that reduces conflict rather than increase it. And I think it takes a lot of skill to do that. And it's not something that people are trained very well in our society, I believe, for the most part, to do. I read some inspiring schools where they have a variety of training for their students. So do we get a gun? or do we train ourselves in nonviolent defense? Do we build a bigger military? Or do we train people in mediation? I mean, there's a wonderful professor at Stanford who's a specialist in international conflict mediation. And that was a specialty. So he's been invited all over the world to mediate conflict. Isn't that great? So he's been trained, and he's trained and studied and all this stuff and developed skills, and now he goes and does this stuff around the country, around the world. Can we do it in our neighborhood? Can we do it, you know? There's people I know here who've trained themselves in restorative justice. Restorative justice is a movement where rather than punishing a criminal, you figure out some way how to restore justice for the whole community. The theory is that when a crime has been committed, a lot of people have been disrupted. The community fabric has disrupted. And so there's a variety of then ways of how to restore a whole community, not just get the person in jail. Because what's more important is rather the restoration of a community than it is to punish someone. And so, in order to restore justice, then it requires the criminal, if the criminal is willing, instead of going to jail, to come forth and meet sometimes with the community, with the victim's family, their own community. Everybody's been affected. And sometimes when they see the whole community, the fabric of who's been affected by their crime, it's very hard to want to do it again. It works sometimes. It probably doesn't work all the time. And to hold up one anecdote and say, look, we had this wonderful program and someone messed up afterwards. Therefore, the program is wrong, I think is really sad. All programs are not going to work 100% of the time. But what is the overall flavor? What's the overall values? What's the overall kind of ethos that we're trying to form in our society? And I think the overall kind of attitude that hopefully we want to create is an attitude that we're all in it together, and that we're all kind of family. We're all kind of collaborators, co-conspirators in creating a peaceful world for each other. And not to feel that there's someone out there, there's them out there, and I can ignore them and push them away so I can preserve my peace. And what I found through Buddhist practice is that it's very hard as you mature in Buddhism or as mindfulness becomes stronger to maintain the illusion that there's someone out there. And it's very hard to maintain the defensiveness or the contraction that keeps me, myself, and mine here, and a wall between me and what's out there. Because it's exhausting to do that. It's actually a kind of violence to ourselves to keep that kind of wall up. If you have the wall up very strongly and create your own kind of kingdom and protect it and push everything else away, it can seem satisfying in it with its own reference points. But once you start relaxing, once you start experiencing a deeper capacity for peace, you see what cost, violent cost, it's been to maintain that kind of sharp separation. So to live a life where we're all in it together, and be interested in training, in learning, in changing, developing ourselves, so that we can be more helpful in this world. I think that what's important is peace, not Buddhism. And in fact, there's been an ancient slogan in Buddhism that the characteristic of the Dharma, what characterizes the Dharma, is nonviolence. Isn't that interesting? What's this Dharma about? Dharma is like Buddhism, right? So what's the characteristic of Buddhism? It's nonviolence. It doesn't say peace. I think it's very interesting. It doesn't say peace. Nirvana, awakening, is characterized by peace. But the Dharma, the teachings and the practices that lead to that peace are characterized by nonviolence. So how do we train ourselves? And I think this is one of the contributions Buddhism has to make. You know, the small thing that Buddhism is, one of the things it contributes. It can contribute practices, it can contribute teachings, it can contribute challenges to us to help us become the kind of people who don't succumb to the movements of greed and hate and delusion in our own hearts. Where there's enough self-understanding here and enough spaciousness or calm so that we don't give in to our impulses. So we begin discovering the precious capacities of our heart to be able to be loving, compassionate, caring, all these things that can exist. Over and over again, the Buddha emphasized that someone who is going to follow the Buddhist path to some degree of maturity becomes someone who lives nonviolently. But how do we live nonviolently and not do it naively, not do it passively? The critique that some people have of adherence of nonviolence is that they're passive, they become too passive. They become kind of pushovers, they're going to just kind of stand there and watch while terrible things happen. Mahatma Gandhi, who was such a champion of nonviolence, had a lot of respect for soldiers. And he said some of his best kind of lieutenants in his movement had been soldiers before they had renounced violence. And what he respected in soldiers was their discipline, their courage, their strength, their forbearance that they had to have, their loyalty, all these beautiful qualities that they had to have in order to serve. And Mahatma Gandhi wanted those same strong strengths of character to be present for the people who weren't passive, but were willing to put themselves out in harm's way to nonviolently try to resolve or deal with a conflict. My own interest in Buddhism, the beginning interest I had in Buddhism, Buddhist practice, was because in 1972, I was of draftable age here in the United States. And the Vietnam War was going on. There was college students who were being shot on campuses in this country. And it was pretty exciting times, for those of you who weren't through that time. And the dorms, thinking about the draft, there was a lot of discussion about what we were going to do if we got drafted. Would we go, would we not go, all that. And so there was a lot of discussion about war, nonviolence. And I was always the extreme pacifist in the group, among my fellow college students, friends. And so I was always, because I was the extreme one, I was always having to defend myself or argue my point various ways. And so as I did this, I got to look at myself in some deeper way. And I realized that if I really was going to live my ideals, I would have to be willing to put myself in harm's way to be able to stand in a demonstration and have a rifle pointed at me, which was happening to people. And I looked at that possibility, and I saw that I was afraid. And I felt too afraid to really feel, I felt like I was probably too afraid to stand there with the rifle pointed at me. And that didn't feel good. This can't be. So I wanted some way to deal with that fear. And as I cast about, how can I deal with this fear? What I came to was Buddhist practice. I don't know, maybe it's coincidence, I don't know, this is what I found. But I identified this kind of Buddhism as a practice. I wasn't so initially interested in Buddhism as a teaching. I was interested in Buddhism as a practice that would help me deal with the attachments, the fears, the senses of self that interfered from being able to live what I really felt was in my heart. And I hope that that's the case for many people, that the Buddhism offers the kind of training that makes us strong, insightful people who can act with great courage and great compassion when we're called on to do that. And none of you know what's coming. None of you know what you're going to be called on to do. And will your compassion and your courage be up to the task that you might have to face? I hope that those of you who are interested in Buddhist practice will find that it helps you to become people who can be compassionate and courageous when it's needed. So then I'll end with this long introduction to what the Buddha had to teach about this topic. Quoting the Buddha, "Better than 1,000 meaningless statements is one meaningful word that brings peace." So there I should end. So thank you.